Good evening, James McCanny here with My Science Hour for June 22nd, 2017. My main science topic tonight, I'll be talking about the upcoming solar eclipse, something very exciting. Usually this happens in Central Africa or Asia or who knows, the Pacific Ocean. But this time, this baby is coming right across the United States of America. So we're going to all have a chance. I don't know if I will be there myself. I'm going to try to be. And I'm not going to tell you where I will be. But at any rate, this swath comes right across the good old US of A. So I'll be talking about that, some solar safety. Don't look at the sun with your eyes and have equipment there. You know, consult specialists on this. I'll just tell you. You don't want to look at any little glimmer of the sun with your naked eye because it'll burn your retinas out. It's that powerful. So be very careful, have the proper equipment. And so anyway, but I'll be talking about the solar eclipse itself, what you might expect, and talk about where you can go to get more information. First of all, this email just in from a listener, so I'm going to go and do a bunch of listener emails tonight, a lot of interesting topics. And I love when people write in because they come up with these questions. I believe it was on one of my paid casts where I described my experience when I was in Ecuador and Peru over a previous couple of years. And I did some traveling there. I was doing some studies. And one of the studies was in Ecuador, in northern Ecuador, and came across, and I kept seeing this, and I saw it in Peru, I kept seeing these little people. And let me just first explain, and you can probably get the idea of where I'm coming from. And of course, in Peru, when you're up in the mountains in the Andes, you see people that are literally 3 feet tall, some of them. They're little. They're humans, of course. But, you know, they've lived up in the mountains in these cold conditions. But you can definitely tell they're of the human race. But I started seeing mixed into the population this completely different. And let me preface this by saying that when I was a kid, I grew up in a town where there were three schools. There was the school for the deaf, school for the blind, and school for the mentally retarded. So they were institutions, but the deaf and the blind kids needed special treatment and certainly special help. Certainly in those days, we had no special education in the schools. And so anyway, that was the choice at the time, is to have a special place for the needs of those kids. But the school for the mentally retarded, we would go up there as kids at Christmas time and sing Christmas carols. And it was like, you know, there really wasn't much point other than we did it to, you know, as a Christian, you know, an effort to try and make them feel a little better, the ones that were, you know, had any sense of communication. But my point is that I had seen as a young kid mentally retarded people, deformed, extreme mental retardation, etc. And so I know what it looks like in all of its varieties, because we went through all of these buildings from those that are relatively good to the ones that were not good at all. Let's just put it that way. So I know what mental retardation looks like, but what I was seeing in Ecuador and in Peru was, and this is the other thing, when I first saw this, it was like I was in shock. I was in shock. And it was instantaneous. Like, remember the movie E.T.? I'm sure everybody has seen the movie E.T. In, you know, the little boy finds E.T. and he's holding him in the closet and he tells the brother, you know, you got to hold a secret. And the older brother's making fun of him. Yeah, super, super secret. You know, don't tell mom. And the little kid opens up the door. And it was great acting, because that's exactly what it's like. When you see that the first time and your eyes meet and it clicks, it's instantaneous shock. And it's not like coming in, like I say, I'd been, had experience with mentally retarded kids and, you know, even adults in these institutions. And of course, it's not pleasant, it's difficult, but you don't go into shock. And so anyway, my point was that I explained this on my show. I'm not going to repeat all of this. I believe it was on a paid cast. But a listener wrote in, and I want to pull up this email. It says, Professor McCanny, thanks for great information. These small people that were evident in Northwest Ecuador, did you hear them speak? And I thought, yeah, this is really a great question. Then it said, then he goes on, he says, I'm not a huge UFO fan, but this sounds convincing. Please keep up your excellent work, etc. So I thought, you know, and that just occurred to me to explain this. So this is what I wrote back. I'll just read my response. I said, interesting question, and no, I did not, meaning I did not hear any speaking or sounds from these I will call them people, for lack of a better word. And then I go on and say, quite frankly, when I was nose to nose with one, I was literally in shock. Like I said, I had as a kid been in mentally retarded institutions because of where I grew up. So that is one feeling. Seeing deformed people so twisted and severe brain damage is one thing. But seeing this literally gave me that feeling you see so well depicted in the movie E.T. Remember the older brother, then the little sister, then the mom? And like you are looking at something from another galaxy and you know it's not from here. And that was the feeling, and it's instant shock and you don't get over it. But no one, I never heard any sounds or speaking from these, as I say, call them people, but it was something, and you see this also in Peru. And like I say, in Peru, you see lots of little indigenous people that are, you know, definitely descendants of the Incas and the Peruvian, the native cultures, etc. And they tend to be very small people. But when I saw this, literally, I went into shock. I was paralyzed. I mean, I couldn't get over it. It was like for hours afterwards, I was still it just took over my mind. It took over my capacities. And of course, I still was breathing and walking and I could chew gum and walk at the same time. But I should also make a note. I got an interesting email from a listener describing, this just came out from Gaia.com. And it was a video, and these videos have been around for a while. And I've been to museums in Peru. I've been in Mexico where I've seen real mummies. In, for example, I think it's Guanajuato or San Miguel de Allende. I forget which one, but down in the basement of this church, they have mummies that have been there for hundreds of years. Very small, obviously small people from that era. The people were much smaller. But there again, you could tell that they were of the human race of this planet. But the situation, and I have talked about meeting Lacandon Indians down in the jungles of Quintana Roo back in, you know, the 1970s, when they were still indigenous and lived off the land, etc. And they were human, you know, very humanoid, people. But the shock that I felt when I saw these people, it was different. That's all I can tell you. It was shockingly different. And now they're doing more studies on these mummies that they're finding, oddly enough, in the Nazca Plains, where I did my study. Released it in December 31st, I believe, of 2015, my white paper, Nazca Lines Mystery Solved, where I show that they are antennas, and not just any antennas, but fractal antennas, along with the integration into interferometers antennas. So this is some of the most complex antenna design known to man, and fractal antennas were only known about on this planet for the last 10 years or so and put into use. But here we have massive, giant fractal antennas all over the plains of Nazca, and now they're digging up these mummies, and they have three fingers, and there's no joint for a fourth finger or a thumb, etc. And so I was trying to look at these and imagine that, in fact, could I relate that to these people that I had seen in Ecuador and in the rural areas of Peru? And I really don't have an answer. All I can tell you is there is research going on in that area. There are real people, real scientists are looking into this. There is some criticism that this is not real science because real science is published in journals, which is a bunch of baloney. I will never publish in a journal again. I mean, I never say never, but it's a racket. It's a monopolized racket for the clubhouses housed in university ivory towers. And they have done a lot of damage to progress in a lot of fields. So when I put out my material, I put it out directly to you, the public, and I review it myself. If I'm not certain of something, I will tell you. If I'm certain of something, I will tell you. But when you're an independent scientist like I am, and over my decades of research, I have had to self-analyze, self-peer review my work. When I did my prime number work, I had to peer review that myself. And I'm much harder on myself than any peer review journal editor ever would be. So at any rate, and so going back to the people that I saw in Ecuador and Peru, so let me describe a little bit about what they looked like. Their eyes were relatively close together, deep set into the face, a very long, very thin triangular nose, actually a quite large nose, but extremely thin. And as I recall, large ears and a very narrow head and very small. And like I say, if I would have had my wits about me more, I would have tried to do more examination, like looking at hands. And the people that I saw were, of course, clothed, so they had shoes on. And but all I can tell you is that it was different than looking at somebody that was mentally retarded or deformed at birth, etc. So anyway, that's a topic that I'll continue to talk about. But it's relative to the idea that the Nazca lines, if you understand that they are fractal antennas woven into this extremely complex interferometer, and interferometer is where you have many antennas that are hooked together in unison and they signal in unison, would be like a piano is a somewhat of an example of an interferometer, so that when you're although the notes are not hooked together necessarily, but an organ might be a better example, an electric organ, where the tones go through a synthesizer and then they come out a speaker or a couple speakers in the front of the organ. So that's a way of synthesizing tones. And so you could think about the Nazca antenna systems being hooked together, which they could unconnect and reconnect at will from the power stations which were on the mounds, which I, by the way, in part two of my Nazca lines paper, I disclosed that the mounds were man-made. And that's a very significant discovery because it appears that that's what they did with all the dirt that came out of the trenches, or they're like troughs. They're very shallow troughs that make up the Nazca lines. They moved the rocks. There was the Nazca plains are covered with rock, and it looks like a very iron-rich rock. That's what it is. And so it's rusty. If you've ever been to an iron-rich area, which I did, I grew up in the Iron Range in Minnesota, part of my youth, and so I know what iron ore looks like and crude iron just laying on the ground in rock form. And it's kind of rusty colored because that's what it is. It's iron oxide. And so the entire plains is strewn with these rocks that are really none of them much bigger than the palm of your hand. That would be a large one, and most of them much smaller. But what the builders of the Nazca lines did is they moved the rocks into piles along these straight lines, and then the figures like the monkey and the whale and the seaweed and the spider, the famous spider, etc. And then they dug out a little bit of a trench, not much, and that was it. And then they all lead by straight line trenches up to these mounds. And that's where they gathered the electricity, the atmospheric electricity, to drive the antenna complex. And this is all explained in my white paper, available on my webpage. But getting back to who did this, it is not apparent to me. And I've been around to digs, archaeological sites, all over the place. I've studied archaeology, and there is nothing of this high-tech caliber anywhere. Now, there are other sites that we've found, and we're starting to build up a bigger repertoire all the time of, and I have that in my second paper also, some of the new sites that have been very obviously have been neglected or ignored, which are fractal antennas also, some of them interferometers connected together. But my point is that we're dealing with technologies here that, you know, you just don't go out, even, say, pyramid builders or even indigenous people that were very creative, that had advanced societies, etc., really did not have the wherewithal to design antennas. I mean, this is I don't think there's anybody who's an absolute expert in all avenues of antenna design. I happen to have my expertise, my areas of expertise. So when I saw the Nazca lines, I immediately knew that these were fractal antennas. And then when I started examining the aerial photos and the mapping and everything that went with it, I said, yeah, these are all connected together into these interferometers. And this is extremely technical material. Extremely technical, and they did it in a whimsical, almost joking way with the animals and figures, which we do not find at any other place on planet Earth. We find the spiral fractal antennas in South Africa, for example. But they don't have the monkeys and the whales and these other figures that really were not from there. Those animals did not exist on the Nazca Plains. So very interesting high technology designs out in the middle of nowhere, designed by who? By the way, in researching, and you know, I'm always doing searches and trying to find out what other people are talking about Nazca lines. It's comical to find the standard scientific community out there trying to present this as, oh, these were paths for water, for irrigation, and satellite photos prove this. Well, no, if you're on the ground at Nazca, you don't need satellite photos to tell you that this is not an irrigation system. This was not a system of irrigation, because why would it go up to the top of these hills? Why would they all connect into the top of a hill? Well, that's not where the water is. That's where the atmospheric electricity is. So you have a bunch of, this is so standard, ding-dong government-supported scientists running around, but it's important for them to do a standard story that does not point to the truth. And therefore they get funding, therefore they get their name in lights and in magazines, etc. But no, if you look at the reality that these were antennas, complex antennas, and it's, and you could even think, well, if, you know, maybe somebody did these in World War II as a joke and just made it up. Well, no, not really, because the Spanish in the 1500s knew about this. But even if you tried to make up such a story, the fractal antennas were not known about until, you know, the last 10 years. And so, you know, clearly, this is not something that you could fake. Let's just put it that way. This was done technically thousands of years ago, and people make estimates, and this is so disgusting. They say that, oh, it was done between 200 BC and 400 AD. They don't know. They don't have a clue. They're just pulling these numbers out of a rabbit's hat so they can publish something, establish something, and then everybody else has to follow that pattern. But believe me, nobody knows when, nor do they know who or what entity created the Nazca Lines. And obviously, they were not all done at once. This was an ongoing project. And the only reason for these was to communicate with other star systems. That's all in my white paper. The question is, who would have done it? Who had the technical ability? And, you know, the entire scenario of how they built them and used them, I discuss in the white paper. So very interesting science going on in the background, something I will continue to talk about. This past week, 60 earthquakes alone on Friday, June 16th, at Yellowstone National Park, 400 over the last week. They call these earthquake swarms. And I've said before where they have to drain the lake at Yellowstone. This is an absolute requirement. When I was on John Moore's show, we were talking about this. It was a number of years ago that I solicited John's help because I thought he would be a good person to go to contact the USGS, the senators, the officials, the U.S. Geological Survey, etc., regarding this topic. And he just hit a dead end. In fact, he was referred to some secretary, and the secretary literally said, "What's an earthquake?" You know, this is typical government, where you're dealing with incompetence all the way from the top scientists down to the lowly secretary. And I don't blame the secretary, but just rampant, vast incompetence in the science, especially in places like the USGS, and the EPA, it's horrible. Now it's changed, of course, thank goodness to Trump. But getting all of that old dead wood out of there that just collect a paycheck and allowed this country to be polluted beyond recognition. Okay, so on to the next topic. I have to make a comment about this because, and it's non-political, but two nights ago there was a special election. I'm sure you all know about this. The Republicans won two seats and the Democrats lost both those seats. And it just seems to be a sign of the times how the Democrats just are so clueless. And I don't think the Republicans are winning because they're that much better. It's just that the Democrats are so clueless that the Republicans are winning. But let me make a more general statement. Republicans in general in the House, they have a majority, the House and the Senate, and of course the presidency, so they have a monopoly. And they're not doing anything. They are not doing anything. They're not there. They're not president. You never see the Republican senators in the news or talking about what they're doing or they're, you know, this is what they worked on today. You don't even hear from them. So my point is that, okay, we now have a president who was actually elected by the people. And really about 80% of the vote went to Trump. And I've showed my studies on this. This is not biased politics. This is reality. But now it's time for regular people to start running for office, I would say, on the Republican ticket. I don't know. Or possibly even the Democratic ticket. Or possibly we need an entirely new party. But that's been tried. Third parties are very difficult. But these old moldy parties, in which the term that's going around today is fairly accurate, it's called deep state, where the senators and the congressmen are simply owned. And so it's very difficult to move forward with any agenda for the populace when the vast majority of people don't even talk to the populace. They're often making backroom deals still. And so, you know, when you try to drain the Washington swamp, it's pretty deep and wide, and it has to be pretty complete. I mentioned on, I believe it was John Moore's show yesterday, but the bottom line is that the fight to take back the United States for the people has just begun. There's a lot more to do, and the average citizen cannot sit back on your haunches and think that everything is going to be taken care of, because it's not. The fight has just begun. And there are people that are on the deep state side, and these are not people that run anything. They're there for greed, for their own success, for their own benefit, and the benefit of their friends and buddies. And that's why the large bank organizations that run everything succeed, because they have so many people operating for their personal greed. And it's a formula for success. It worked in Rome. It's working in the United States. But the main point is that in the 2016 presidential election, my mathematical analysis, and now I've added another tier to this, that the Democratic Party had switched tons and tons of Bernie Sanders votes to Hillary Clinton. And a lot of those people did not vote or voted for some other party, but they literally switched them. And so that's another factor where there's no way in the world she got more than 40 million votes. Donald Trump got about 82 million votes, according to my calculations. Just a quick mention, the Hanford, Washington radiation facility, which is still active, they say in the news that it's shut down, but it's still, there still are operations going on there. But there has been radiation waste stored there since World War II. And now it's flowing into the Columbia River. And I just can't believe this. Now they're blaming Trump, that it's Trump's fault. Well, he's been in office 5 months. This has been there since World War II. And even though this has been designated a super site cleanup area, they still have not done really anything to contain this. And this is just the tip of the iceberg relative to nuclear containment of waste from nuclear facilities, both military and electrical, the waste from electrical generation plants. There was a 4.0 earthquake in Greenland this past week. 84 people had to evacuate. When I got the message, it said mass evacuation in Greenland, and I guess with a population of 84, if you lived there, you might consider it a mass evacuation. But I believe there was 4 people missing. But what happened is there was an earthquake about 30 miles north of this little town that's right on the coast. I mean, these people built their little houses. And like when you travel in central Canada or out in the country in Canada or up into Nova Scotia, or in this case, Greenland, very modest housing where the people live. And they're obviously fishermen. They live right on the sea. They had boats with outboard motors on them. And they had to move to higher ground. But there was a tsunami. And really, it was just a large wave. It was kind of like a extra large wave that rolled in and basically amongst the houses. There are videos of this online. But in an area like that, it's hopefully these people will be able to build and move their houses up to higher ground where they will not have this incidence of, I would not really call it a tsunami. It was just a large wave that moved in. But still devastating for those poor people that live there. And this is very typical of a lot of parts of the world where people live a very meager existence. Very wonderful people, hardworking people, and with their families there. But, you know, just nature is not very forgiving. This in from a listener that in 1871, Antonio Meucci invented the telephone. This is very interesting, and posthumously has been given credit for inventing the telephone, that device that all of us use literally every day. And the patent was actually filed in 1871, 6 years, 5 years later, by Alexander Graham Bell. And he was given the patent, and almost immediately, within a year, there was an investigation opened and never completed. So up until 2002, the patent for the telephone remained with Alexander Graham Bell as the inventor. But in 2002, the U.S. Senate reversed the patent, and internationally now, Antonio Meucci, a name you should get to remember instead of Alexander Graham Bell. And it turns out that Bell was working in the same laboratory as Meucci. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's an Italian name. But the Antonio was so poor, he did not have the $10 to pay for the patent and complete it. And so, at any rate, just a brief announcement. There is some justice in time. And hopefully, those are the kind of things that give me encouragement that with time, history will set straight the discoverers of the things that I've done in my life. And because when you're not in the system, there's nobody there to provide record keeping other than my own, which I have a very definite paper trail. But that just gives me hope that someday the justice will be done regarding the true historic development of my work. On August 21st, there's going to be an eclipse of the sun. That'll be my main science topic, and I'll talk more about that. There was a small comet in 2014 that passed through the solar system. It reached perihelion in, 2014. And that means that was its closest point to the sun. It had a 700-year orbit, which means we probably have no record of this comet being around in the inner solar system historically. But what it did is it possibly left a trail of debris. And this is common in my plasma discharge comet model. I tell how this occurs. The induced electric dipole force is fairly strong when you're near the charged comet nucleus. And so any grains of dust or sand or small objects that have even a trace of metal in them, the induced electric dipole force works on those and is attractive. So the comet is constantly attracting matter into its orbit. And these tend to follow the comet. And then when the comet moves away, these objects remain in orbit around the sun. And so on the 29th of July, the Earth will pass through this region of space where the comet was in 2014 during perihelion. So there's a chance, and they say only in South Africa. So some of my listeners down in South Africa, on the 29th, and the data on this, you can find it on the internet. The name of the comet is, let me just pull this up. The comet name is Comet Borisov. Let me spell that. It's Borisov. So if you're in South Africa, 29th of July, have a heads up for the potential, and all the data for this you can find on the internet. But very interesting. The reason I'm mentioning this also is that there are meteor streams that Earth passes through that we don't know where these came from. We have certain ones we know are associated, for example, with Halley's Comet. Because Halley's Comet is an Earth, its orbit has crossed Earth's path. So that's a potential, that's a known source of meteorites when we come to that meteorite stream. But there's other meteorite streams that we go through that we don't know about. And then there's other meteorite streams that we will never go through with Earth. For example, Hale-Bopp, I'm sure, has a very healthy meteor stream that comes around and Actually, potentially we could, because Hale-Bopp nearly, I think it came within 1 million miles of Earth's orbit. So, no, I'm wrong on that. Let me correct myself that potentially we could see meteor streams from Comet Hale-Bopp. And that's something we could look for. And those could be very large, because Comet Hale-Bopp was a very large comet. But my point is that many comets have come through the solar system for which we have no record. And this comet, Borisov, is a perfect example. It was a small comet, nothing major, nothing, you know, this is not a comet that is going to affect Earth. We might see a couple of meteorites, but there are comets that have left major streams of debris that potentially we could move through, and some of them could be fairly large and make it all the way to the ground before they burn up. But the really big comets in history have also left meteor streams. And as I say, we don't really know where all of the meteor streams came from, what comet they were associated with. So there's a lot going on in outer space that we do not have good physical records that go back into history. Oh, that reminds me also that in, I think it was 2004, I had a comet watch. There were two comets that were going to interact with the planet Mercury, as I remember. But all of this is on my webpage. If you dig down into my webpage, follow the trees down into my historically important subpages, you will find the story on this and the questionnaire that I sent out to people. But I decided to have a worldwide amateur astronomer competition to take pictures of this comet and see that if we could actually see the sunward spike. And these were broadside views of the comet, which meant that the standard explanation for sunward spikes in comets, which was an optical illusion, is what standard science calls them, was really not a possibility. And so this was a perfect example. So I announced it on my show. I got people responding. I set up a separate email account, especially just to handle that traffic, that email traffic from the amateur astronomers around the world. And I was getting a good response. And so everybody was getting set up. I sent out the information sheet, the dates, the times, when to look, where to send the photos once they took the photos, etc. And all of a sudden, the other shoe dropped. People that were emailing me were getting threatened. They had their email shut off. My email was hacked. My webpage was hacked. And clearly, somebody did not want me setting up my own personal international comet watch with amateurs and communicating with them. NASA then came along and set up its own version of what I was doing. So they wanted all the amateurs to send the pictures to them. And of course, they could doctor the photos or interpret them. And of course, I was cut out of this project. And this is just standard fare. This is the kind of thing I have been dealing with all my life. Or for example, American Geophysical Union meeting. I went and I had my posters, one of my posters that you can buy on my webpage. But I had my poster there. And it was a poster session, which is a common way of presenting at American Geophysical Union meetings. And I had it printed on small 11 by 17 sheets. And I left them in the press room. Well, as soon as I would leave them, I'd walk out the door and I'd come back 5 minutes later. Somebody had picked them up and I could see them in the garbage can. So somebody was following me around. Whenever I would talk to someone or ever I would leave one of my posters, somebody would be right behind me, threatening that person, taking away my poster, not allowing my information to be presented. And here's kind of a funny story. This is an actual true story. This was back in probably 1986. I was at the American Geophysical Union meeting, and I believe it was in San Francisco. And there was a closed session meeting about the results of NASA getting information on Comet I believe it was Comet Halley's Comet, or in conjunction with European Space Agency, or it might have been Giacobini-Zinner. But at any rate, I was not allowed to into the news session. It was a closed-door news session. And so at any rate, I was going to go up and see if I could stand by the door and listen or whatever. And so I get in the elevator, and I'm going up the elevator, and there's a guy named Tom, and I can't remember his name offhand, his last name, but he was a news reporter for like the New York Times or one of the big news outlets for science. And I said to him, why don't you ask a question? I said, have they considered any other comet models besides the Dirty Snowball Comet model? And I just dropped that kind of bombshell question in his ear. And so we get up to this floor where the news conference was being held. He gets out, I get out, he goes into the news conference because he's got his news badge. And of course, I'm standing outside, and somebody saw me and they slammed the door in my face. And so anyway, as I understand, the guy asked the question and he was immediately fired from his job. They went and they said, this guy is out of here. And of course, he was young and green, didn't know what was going on, but he lost his job because he asked that question in a NASA news release, that whether they were considering any other models besides the Dirty Snowball Comet model. Anyway, just another story in the pile of stories that I've been through throughout my history. The reason I'm mentioning this is because when the August 21st solar eclipse comes, there's some very good science that can be done by amateurs around the United States regarding basically general relativity. But let me first make a quick announcement, because I'm heading into the main science topic here. Before I get going, I want to talk about this week's paid cast. It's in the ongoing series Tesla's Mind. It's part 13. It's called Ether or Not, The Nature of Electromagnetic Radiation from Newton to Tesla to Michelson to Einstein to Emma Wolf. And it's a very interesting discussion regarding the electromagnetism and the search, which ended up dry. I mean, they did not find ether. There's still people that are proposing experiments for ether. But ether was originally, Aristotle had talked about ether. Newton had talked about ether because he understood the wave-like nature of light. And so he believed there had to be some medium, just like water or sound through a steel bar or whatever. There had to be some form of medium to transmit the waves. And so anyway, the search went on, and finally in the, 1888 was it, that Michelson Morley did their famous experiment searching for the ether and came up with a negative result. And they should have easily been able to record the flow of the ether, and they came up with nothing. And that's when Einstein, 1905, came up with his amazing analysis of the idea that light moves in at the speed of light relative to the observer. In other words, that if you're moving and you send out a beam of light that leaves you at the speed of light, but if there's another observer that's moving towards you or away from you, that it comes to them at the speed of light. Totally nonsensical. But when you combine that with the known equations of electromagnetism, you come back to Maxwell's equations and the fact that there is no ether. So these are, in fact, if Einstein, I have something I would say, that if Einstein had not discovered and proposed special relativity, we would probably still be in the dark today. So that's how subtle and important that was. But anyway, this week's paid cast, and I talk about Tesla, Tesla's opinion on ether. Tesla was a big advocate of ether. And so at any rate, that's this week's paid cast, $3.95 a month. And you can join on my webpage. Just go to the jmccsci.com. Also, by the way, the sale, I don't know how much longer it'll be on, but probably not much longer, but I have the 10% off plus an additional 5% off, which is amazing. I mean, it's just unheard of. And with the pollution that's around the country, everybody really needs a water filter. And mine are the only ones that take everything out all in one filter element. And so there's no expensive add-on filter elements. Nobody else tells you that when they're advertisement. They won't tell you that you got to buy add-on filters just for arsenic and fluoride, and they don't. Their filters don't take out the majority of heavy metals or volatile chemicals or anything else. You know, they might take out some dirt and sludge and stuff, and maybe a little bacteria. But my filters are the only ones that take out everything all in one filter element, so no expensive add-ons. But anyway, that sale is still going on. Plus, remember, I have the big commercial models now, the high flow rate models, all of that. They're 10% off plus an additional 5% off, and most of these have free shipping. So anyway, once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. Okay, so I was talking about special and general relativity relative to solar eclipses. Okay, well, now let's go back to the Eddington experiment that occurred in, it was 1919. So this was 14 years after Einstein's special relativity was published. And so Einstein had moved on to a more general concept of curved space-time, etc. And Eddington was a physicist, astronomer, who really, really capitalized on the idea of general relativity and the idea that only a few people in the world understood it. And at the time, it was a fairly complicated topic. But the point is, Eddington went to a tropical location, took equipment, set it up, and there were other people trying to do this also, who came up with not so clear results. And it's very questionable what Eddington did. We're still trying to piece that together. There's still a lot of controversy. But anyway, basically, there was a solar eclipse, and that's exactly what we're going to have on August 21st this summer. And the line of the solar eclipse comes right across the central USA. So all of you are going to be able to see this. At any rate, when you have about 2 or 3 minutes of total blockage of the sun, the total eclipse is complete. In other words, the moon, and this is very strange because we don't know of any other moon in the solar system that is so perfectly positioned that on the surface of the Earth, the moon, our moon, perfectly blocks out the disk of the sun, the bright part. And so with that in the wave, with a total eclipse, you can see the corona, you can see the rays, you can see... I would love to have an amateur program for this. Now, here's the way it would work. In 1919, Arthur Eddington did an experiment. He went to a remote location. There was a total eclipse of the sun. He first takes a picture of that area of the sky where the next day the solar eclipse would occur. And so he has the position of all the stars in the photos. The next day, the sun and the moon have a conjunction. The moon blocks out all of the light from the sun, making the sky, you can see the stars. And so he takes a picture of the same region of the sky. And now he goes back to the laboratory, takes and compares the two photos. And because they were looking for a bending of light due to general relativity, that somehow light should be affected by gravity, and they make some measurements. Now, here's where the iffy part comes in historically. When people go back and try and re-examine Eddington's work, some people say he fudged the data so that it came out just right. Some people say that, no, his methods were sound. So it's not exactly something that's, let's say, 100% agreement. But from what I know now, it's not the gravity of the sun that affects the light bending around the sun. It's the electromagnetic field of the sun. It's actually the non-uniform electric field of the sun, and that's created by the excess current of protons in the solar wind, and it's variable. Now, when I was at Cornell, and I've talked about this on radio shows, in my paid cast, in my astronomy, my DVD that is for sale on the webpage, the university level astronomy, astrophysics, space science course, DVD number 4. I talk about this. When I was at Cornell, every day after school, there were meetings, sometimes 2 or 3, where data was coming in from spacecraft. And so anyway, some of the scientists who were dealing with a satellite in orbit around Venus decided to take advantage of that, as they do a lot of times, doubling up, doing interesting experiments that were not originally planned with the satellite that was orbiting Venus, doing studies of Venus. But anyway, that spacecraft was sending radio signals back to Earth. And so as Venus moved around to occult behind the sun, and as, of course, therefore the satellite moved along with it, they wanted to make measurements for general relativity of the bending of the radio waves. And so therefore, it would appear that the satellite and Venus were out farther than what they really should be. And so anyway, they took this data with radio telescopes, because radio telescopes tend to be much more accurate than optical telescopes. And so anyway, the data came back in. I was in the meeting when they were examining the data. End result was that the data was all over the place. It looked like the satellite was bouncing back and forth, and Venus was bouncing back and forth, and they couldn't reconcile this data with any actual theoretical work. So they couldn't figure out what was going on. And I'm sitting in the back room, or the back row, going, oh my goodness, this is my induced electric dipole redshift. But the end result was that they did not publish the data. And as with the case with when Halley's Comet came through the solar system, I've told this story before, a group of scientists went to South America with good telescope equipment, spectrometers, and they looked at the light coming from Halley's Comet. And the light that was coming out from the nuclear region of the comet was redshifted. And it was not due to motion. It was not, of course, comets are not massive. So it was not due to general relativity, some massive object in the middle of the comet. And so once again, they threw away all the data because it did not match anything that they understood. And data that contradicts current thought is important because it's real data. And then somebody else would go out and measure redshift from other comets and go, hey, these comets are producing redshifts. You know, what's going on here? We need an explanation. I mean, measurements are measurements. That's what science is all about. Not popular vote, not hiding the data, not sequestering information and guarding it so that nobody sees it. Science is about inquiry that is based on experiment. Okay, so anyway, what I wanted amateurs to do is to go out and with their equipment, now they only have about 3 minutes to do this, about 2.5 minutes where you have what they call totality. In other words, the moon is completely blocking out the sun. You only have about 3 minutes, but you would have to be there the night before to take a picture of that same region of the sky and have a good picture. You could do it a few nights before or whatever, but you would want a picture relatively the same time frame of that region of the sky, and then be able to compare it to the pictures you took when the solar eclipse was occurring of that same region of the sky. And so what would that do? That would allow you to compare the pictures. In my prediction, now if we say had 100 amateurs doing this, we could compare the photos that they took of that region of the sky that was over their location when the total eclipse was occurring, and then the total eclipse pictures of the same region of the sky, and compare them and see if, in fact, there is a common factor that you would expect from general relativity, because the mass of the sun is constant. It, of course, is burning off energy at a very slow rate relative to its total mass. E equals mc squared is generating the light and the heat and the other energy we see coming out of the sun, the electrical energy included. But the mass of the sun is very stable. And so you should expect exacting bending of light or movement of the star patterns And so if we had hundreds of people doing this experiment and then sending me the data, I could, in fact, look at this data and make determinations. Now, any amateur can do this. In fact, amateurs, this is an interesting point, amateurs today have much better equipment than Sir Arthur Eddington had in 1919. And really, nobody has gone back and done this experiment, the Eddington experiment. And then general relativity was railroaded into prominence and never really revisited. And so then, and this is a comment, a criticism of Tesla, of the space science, astronomy, astrophysics community, said they've gone up in the mathematical Neverland, Neverland, and have never come back. And that's true today. The black holes and the string theory and the, and oh my goodness, it's the Big Bang and all this stuff is based on extremely small data sets. Very, very, very weak data sets. And Einstein, before he died, he wrote an autobiography called Out of My Later Years. And he stated in there that he did not believe general relativity because it did not include the total field. And I've talked about this a lot. So I come along at Cornell, 1979. I'm looking at all this data. It's very clear to me. I mean, I spoke with Halton Arp, who had mounds of data showing galaxies and quasars connected together that had very different redshifts. And very clearly, I had the solution. But in the world of astronomy, astrophysics, I had been blackballed. So my work could never be published. And here we are, decades later, almost approaching four decades. And my work on the induced electric dipole redshift, which is laboratory provable. We have done experiments in the laboratory because you can get a laser, you can get the large non-uniform electric fields in a laboratory, and it works. I mean, it works. You can show it. You can demonstrate it. I've done this in classrooms in front of people, but you can't get it published in the journals because they don't want to hear anything about it. It contradicts the standard status quo. So at any rate, I'll be talking more about August 21st, the solar eclipse coming up, and possibly we can get together some amateurs. I'm not going to do anything formal because I will be blocked. My webpage will be hacked. But maybe if people can go out and actually do this, tell your amateur friends to listen to this show, go out and do this experiment, and then we'll talk about how to get the data to me. We'll find a route for them to get the data to me. So at any rate, I'm just about out of time here. Remember, go to the webpage, join the weekly paid cast, $3.95 a month. That's really a big help to me. Remember also the sale, the 10% plus extra 5% off on major water filter products are there on the sales page, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.